You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Friday, which means it's time to get you updated with all the news that made headlines this week. So it's time for our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Joining me live in studio today, Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television, George Prentice with the Boise Weekly, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News. Happy Friday.
Hello.
To you.
Okay, we want to start, Seth, with you. I want you to get us updated with public defender guidelines, but take us back. Give us a little bit of history and background first.
Yeah, this isn't the first time that public defense in Idaho has been a problem. I mean, we've had studies for the last 10 years basically saying that our indigent defense system is not up to par. There was a huge study based around the, I think it was Nez Perce County's defense attorneys there, where they were doing contracting. They just couldn't meet the workload. And this has kind of gone on for the last 10 years leading up to now. We have a looming ACLU lawsuit that's in court right now, basically saying that we are not meeting our constitutional duties in Idaho to provide public defense to people. I mean, this is all going to kind of come to a head in April. There's been a public defense commission put together that's trying to deal with a lot of this stuff, and the Idaho legislature is also trying to kind of cut off the lawsuit at the pass, trying to figure out a way to get this system working, get it up to constitutional snuff before a court kind of steps in, takes over, and tells Idaho what they're going to do. A lot of this actually does have to do with budgeting, too, because the state of Idaho has kind of outsourced a lot of the financing and a lot of the oversight of these systems to the counties. And that kind of that shift has made it even more complicated. What happened this week is the Idaho legislature approved rules that would put certain workload standards on public defenders in Idaho, basically saying you can't do more than a certain amount of felony cases, a certain amount of misdemeanor cases, a certain amount of capital cases in a year, or else you're basically being overworked. You're not able to provide an adequate defense system. Our standards that we just put into place, they're approved by the House and Senate rules, and not rule, judiciary committees, they did it in rules, basically say that, let me pull up the numbers here. They worked off a survey that BSU did that basically said there's 2,080 work hours in any given year. And then they started saying you can do this many cases in those hours. The thing that I thought was interesting, if you do that math, a 40-hour work week, you divide 2,080 hours, you get 52 weeks. That's 52 weeks in a year. That's 40 hours a week every week of the year.
Yeah, working no vacation. Caseload, yeah.
No vacation, no sick leave. And that also means no administrative stuff. That means no travel time. I mean, that means you're working a ton. So these standards that they put in, basically, one could argue, and I think the ACLU does argue, they were kind of backwards engineered to fit the system that we have right now. It wouldn't put a whole lot of defense offices in Idaho in jeopardy. They'd only have to add, I think it was like a few new lawyers into the system to make it work under these standards. But they're also higher than standards called the NAC standards, which the American Bar Association said is the absolute limit that any public defender should have. Like they say, do not go over these. Those are made back in the 70s, so they're kind of obsolete. But the American Bar Association says if those were the standards in the 70s, when you add in audio recordings, when you add in video recordings, when you added body cams, a lot of the work that goes into a felony case or a misdemeanor case actually takes more time now. So going over those NAC standards is even more problematic. So the idea with these standards would maybe help the state of Idaho's case in court with this ACLU lawsuit saying that the public defender system is unconstitutional. The ACLU is saying that this could actually hurt them more because this actually proves that they're going way over the workload that they should.
What's interesting to me about this, though, is that I haven't heard a conversation in this about looking. You brought up budget, right, and how it's budgeted throughout the state. And as we know, Ada County and Kootenai County get the most money, but they also have the largest cases. I mean, the most cases you see are in Ada County. So there's always this argument about money. But then when you look at the prosecutor's office and the public defender's office, the prosecutors have a built-in investigative team. They have the police department. The public defenders, they have to hire private detectives. You know, they have to hire investigators. They have all of this other workload that they have to hire out. And that doesn't come up in the conversation.
And the Idaho counties have always pushed back against workload standards, because they know that there's going to be a cost attached to these things. And it's not just rural counties. You brought up Kootenai and Ada. They're two of the counties that will be most affected by these workload studies.
Absolutely.
They're
going to
be hit because most of the cases are there, despite the fact that they're large offices. They're handling most of the cases. Talking to some people within the community, they're kind of bringing up more like fundamental ideas, basically saying like maybe if we want these workload standards, we just need to talk to prosecutors and tell them not to prosecute as many things. Maybe don't bring as many misdemeanor cases. Maybe if this is the amount of money that you want to spend and this is the defense system that you want, just don't prosecute everything. And then they can actually meet those guidelines.
Well, make deals.
Well, and that's what they're doing
right
now.
Right.
I mean, if you look at it, it's plea deal after plea deal after plea deal. And in a lot of these communities, like, that's the only way the public defender can get by. They can't put in the time to go to trial to do all the research. It's much easier to say, let's, you know, we can drop the charge down a little bit, take the plea deal and move on.
Let's talk about the Women's March. And George, we had the two young organizers on the program yesterday. They are juniors in high school in Boise. This is the third year we've had the Women's March. And it's always been high school students who have really, you know, run the charge with this. But what happened with the city of Boise?
They ran into some friction, and I don't think anyone was expecting this. We were sitting in on the special events committee to cover another story, and then this came up, and you would think it's a rubber stamp approval. And a representative from ACHD, the Ada County Highway District, which manages the roads, et cetera, and said, if we had our druthers, we'd pull the permit right now. And the city clerk said, this is a disaster. We can't communicate with these folks. Well, these folks are, as you said, a couple of high school students.
Mm-hmm.
And the previous organizers were high school students, but they were 16 going on 30. They were pretty impressive. And so when we reached out to these young ladies, they said, yeah, that's on us. We're new to this. And quite frankly, it's not going to be a march tomorrow. They're not going to let them march from City Hall to the State House. And by the way, women is spelled WMXN this year, the Women's March, to include, be more inclusive, if you will. They said, yeah, we learned our lesson. We're keeping our fingers crossed for tomorrow. What is impressive is they're bringing in the former White House spokesperson, Jennifer Palmieri, to be their guest speaker. I think that'll be impressive. That said, there hasn't been a lot of buzz about the Women's March this year when you consider that 5,000 people plus were there 2 years ago and 3,000 last year. There will be marches all over the globe tomorrow. But I think it'll be who knows how many people will show up. It's about social media, et cetera. But I think they're playing catch up. And I bet they wish they had another week to promote this.
Right. I would agree with that because, there, as you said, there hasn't been a lot of info out there about it until this week.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, wow. And there has been a lot of info on the national level.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
With the founders of the Women's March nationally not condemning Louis Farrakhan for certain supposedly anti-Semitic comments that he's had. And the press and the buzz for this is not really focused on the women. It's not really focused on the march. It's been focused on a lot of these
tension
other
within.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to watch to see how many people do show up to the streets of D.C. in particular tomorrow. The organizers of the Boise's March openly said we're actually looking toward next year's march more than this year's march. So they're keeping their fingers crossed.
It's still impressive, though, that for the 3 years that Boise has done this, that the charge has been led by high school students.
Yeah.
And that is a big life lesson. I mean, things like this with the city, with ACHD. But, I mean, I think you still have to remember that they are 16-year-olds taking this on.
Events are so improvisational. Event planning is anything but.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, Kevin, you wrote a story this week about teacher pay in Idaho. It's up?
Right. It's up in the aggregate.
Well, I know that question. It's up?
No,
really?
What we did, and we've done this for a couple of years now, is we looked at the statewide averages in terms of teacher pay. And I want to emphasize and underline that this is an average. So individual teacher salaries vary widely, and what districts and charters do across the state varies widely. So having laid out all of those disclaimers up front, the average salary increased by 3.4% this year. It brings the average close to the $50,000 mark. It's about $49,700 is your average teacher salary across the state. And over the course of the 4 years since Idaho adopted the career ladder, this five-year plan to raise teacher salaries, the average salary has increased by about 12.5%. Why is that all important? Politically, it sort of establishes a backdrop for what I think is going to be a really important legislative session in the arena of teacher pay. Governor Brad Little has talked about trying to raise the beginning salary to $40,000 a year. Right now, that starting salary is $35,800. So what he's talking about in terms of an increase in the minimum salary, pretty significant. We found that there are a couple of school districts and a couple of charter schools where the average teacher salary isn't even $40,000 a year, let alone the salary for new teachers coming in the door. So this $40,000 minimum is a big deal. It front loads more money into the beginning end of the salary schedule, kind of like the career ladder has done. So it doesn't do as much for veteran teachers, but it's still a significant proposal. You have proposals to try to provide premiums for those veteran teachers, like $4,000 premium for high-quality veteran teachers. That's a controversial proposal, even within the teaching community. There are teachers who aren't convinced that this is going to work, that there's a lot to the process of applying for one of these premiums and some skepticism about whether the money is actually going to materialize after teachers do this work to put together a portfolio. And this legislature still has to figure out what to do with the final installment of the career ladder. Do you put more money into teacher salary? Do you wrap up the five-year plan? I think they do. I think there's a lot of sentiment around the State House that this is something that was promised and you need to make good on the promise and fund the 5 years. But what happens next? Little has talked about creating a new task force to look at K-12 issues, which would obviously mean looking further at teacher salaries. There are folks in the education community who say, hey, wait a minute. Okay, we're talking about a $40,000 minimum, but way back in 2013, the task force that Butch Otter put together talked about not just a $40,000 minimum, but a $60,000 top-end salary for veteran teachers. We're not there with this career ladder. We're not even close to a $60,000 maximum. So I think there are folks in the education community who are saying, we need to do more for veteran teachers. Mm. We need to do more to make it possible for teachers to stay in the classroom, to continue teaching, and teach in the communities that they are in now, where they may enjoy teaching, where they may have ties to the community, so that a teacher doesn't feel like he or she has to go from a smaller community to Boise or to cross the border
into Oregon or
Washington or Wyoming or Utah to get a pay raise. So a lot of teacher pay issues in play. So we wanted to look at where the numbers are right now to sort of provide a little bit of a backdrop.
And we can't forget that as we've been raising teacher pay, so have in our neighboring states as well.
Right.
So we're not necessarily leapfrogging anyone because Oregon, Washington,
so it's still Utah more attractive to potentially go across the border.
Exactly. Right. And we're still seeing a lot of our teachers leave in those first 4 years. That's when most of them either leave the classroom altogether or go find another job outside of Idaho.
Right. And another thing I tried to do this week for a different story, actually, is a blog post, was trying to look at, if we go to a $40,000 minimum salary, how does that stack up nationally and how does that stack up in the region? It's hard to say, but the best numbers that I could find, the most current numbers I could find, Idaho's starting teacher salary is low compared to almost every neighboring state. I think we're ahead of Montana, but that's it. And our starting salary is a couple of years old, so the numbers aren't very current, is one of the lowest in the nation. I think we're ahead of only about five or six states. So we've got a lot of ground to make up. And again, to Seth's point, if you're trying to keep teachers and try to be competitive with neighboring states, you have to keep an eye on what's going on with salaries in neighboring states. That's, you know, simple economics.
Is there any indication of whether the exodus has slowed down?
I don't have any hard data to suggest that it's slowing down or maintaining or picking up, but you hear anecdotal evidence from educators and administrators all over the state saying we've got shortages and shortages in specific areas, especially like special education, some of the STEM fields, I think it's still a problem, and I don't think it's a problem that's going to go away anytime soon.
And there's not really a good way of tracking it. I know the University of Idaho a couple of years ago was trying to keep track of basically people that they graduated with an education background, education degree, see where they ended up. They were just instituting that about 2 years ago. I don't think they really have the hard data, because something like this will take a little while to see if there are trends where kids are, or where teachers are going if they're staying here.
And the State Board did release a study about a month ago about the attrition rates. It's not really the exodus necessarily, but it is the attrition rates of people leaving the profession, maybe not leaving the state, but leaving the profession. And those numbers were pretty startling as well.
And especially when you can work as a mechanic and probably make more money, right, and you don't have a bunch of kids yelling at you.
Well, there you go. We are back with our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guest today, George Prentice with the Boise Weekly, Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television, and Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. Now, I know we could continue to talk about things with the legislature and what's going on since we are in the midst of the session. But it seems the news of the day is really about pro soccer coming to Treasure Valley.
The important stuff.
So I had to dig out an interview that I did with Merritt Paulson, who's the CEO of the Portland Timbers. And it was here at Boise State Public Radio. And it was about 6-7 years ago. He came into town for City Club. And if you remember, Kevin, during City Club, he talked about how many season ticket holders for the Portland team that they have in the Treasure Valley that regularly travel over to Portland. And he basically said, if you ever get your act together and get a facility,
if you build it, they will come.
That's exactly right. And so the announcement is from Aegon, which is the owners of the Boise Hawks, and also the same gentleman who is the developer who wants to build a sports stadium, a multi-use stadium, as they call it, here in Boise, has signed a commitment to bring a professional but minor league soccer franchise to this community. Of course, the question is, where do they play? Well, oh, gosh, I also happen to want to build a stadium.
Oh, look at that.
Talk about sweetening the deal. This is the most transparent story you're going to see.
Yeah.
That said, this is going to be the talk of a few family conversations. It's like, Mom, Dad, wow, we're going to get a pro soccer team.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me where to sign.
Well, and Kevin, you mentioned something during the break that I thought was interesting, is that when we look back a couple of years when the Basque Friendly happened, that was at Bronco Stadium, sold out crowd.
They had like close to, I think, between 25 and 30,000 there, and it was a great atmosphere. I went and loved it. I'm a soccer fan. I'm not a fan of the soccer team from the largest city in Oregon. I'm a Sounders guy.
Wow.
But I think soccer is just going to take off in Boise if and when, and hopefully now when, a professional team is here. I think it's a no-brainer. I think this town's ready to embrace soccer. I'm ready to embrace it.
The stadium story needed a bit of good news, too.
And I would argue that soccer's already taken off in Boise. When you look at the youth soccer leagues, when you look at the season ticket holders going to Timbers games, I have arguments with people about MLS games now. I mean, people do talk about soccer here in Boise. It's surprising, like, the amount of difference you have between, like, 10 years ago when you bring up an MLS team and no one would, they'd look at you in the face with the dead eyes. Now everyone actually is involved.
And you go back a few years to the World Cup when the U.S. was in 2014, and then the Women's World Cup the following year, if you went to sports bars to watch those matches, big crowds, really engaged crowds. It wasn't just, you know, be there to be there, but there were fans there really
at 7 a.m.
absorbing the action and really locked into the action. So, I think Seth is right, and I was wrong. This is already a soccer
city. So here's what's interesting to me then. So they make this commitment for the pro soccer team. How do you think that affects people who have been anti-stadium who may be pro-soccer?
Oh, wow. You're really slicing that two ways. Sometimes I think those dots don't connect. The people who are anti-stadium are really anti-stadium. I do believe it's part of Mayor Beter's legacy wish list. And indeed, he's up for office this year. I think the stadium becomes a political, pardon the pun, but you know, soccer ball to be kicked around. But he can stand up in front of people and say, for goodness sakes, we actually have a commitment here.
And
it helps sell it.
And it is something to sell. I mean, you couldn't really sell baseball because we already had baseball.
Right.
You know, this is something new that you get along with the stadium that I think does kind of help the sales pitch there. And the other thing to think about is that North America is going to have the World Cup coming up here in a few years. Like, if you could get in on the ground floor, build a stadium, get a soccer team in here, I mean, you're going to be at about the right time period to actually really profit from that new...
And most of those games will be here in the States, some in Mexico, some in Canada.
Exactly.
But I think lion's share will be here, right?
Yeah,
right.
So, and probably several of them in Seattle is one of the cities that's on the short list for that.
Fantastic.
And if you look at the jump in spectating after, was it the 94 World Cup that was here? I mean, there was a huge spike. Mm-hmm. Dwindled off because there wasn't really a major soccer league in the United States to get onto. But now with the MLS and possibly with a team coming to Boise, you can put your enthusiasm towards something.
Right. I think it softens or potentially softens some of the criticism.
That's what I would think. So I want to talk about climate change because Governor Little spoke at the Idaho Environmental Forum. They have a legislative update that they do every year at the beginning of the session, spoke Wednesday. And I think to maybe the surprise of many, he kind of went outside the party line saying that climate change is real and we need to do something about it.
Well, I think that's something that you've kind of started seeing as a change in the Republican talking points nationally. In our debate with Representative Mike Simpson, Congressman Mike Simpson, he kind of had a similar line of, I believe in climate change. I believe it's happening. The next step is, what do you do about it? And you're starting to see that coming out of Republicans nationally and obviously here in Idaho's mouth now. It's not that they're going to deny climate change. It's, what steps can we really take? Sometimes we just deal with the repercussions of it. Sometimes there's, steps that you can make as far as clean energy things. But they haven't gone to like the Democrats are with like a Green Deal for America or anything like that. But it seems that they're no longer fighting its existence. The fight now is what steps you take and whether or not it's worth, putting regulations on business that they don't necessarily like to do in order to combat it.
A year ago, though, the chairman of the House Resources Committee echoed the president and said climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese to sell us solar panels. He retired.
Right.
He has since retired. That said, the current Senate, and I want to make sure I get this quote here, current chair of that same committee, Representative John Vanderwoody, quoting here, I don't think that man controls the environment near as much as what a lot of people think they do. You still have to get a hearing. Representative Alana Rebell asked for a hearing on some of these issues last year and has yet to get one. Let's see how far it gets. I don't know how much Brad Little and his comments before the Idaho Environmental Committee, by the way, or their annual legislative forum. So let's see how much traction it actually gets.
Yeah, and to use a terrible pun, I think you're right. I don't think the climate within the Idaho legislature has necessarily changed as much as nationally.
Yep.
There you go.
Yep.
Kevin, so you did another story about high school graduation rates topping 80% mark in 2018.
Right. This is significant. I mean, I feel like I'm always here talking about really grim education statistics,
right.
But this was
every once in a while, we want you to have good news.
This was actually some solid improvement. The state's high school graduation rate improved by close to one percentage point. When we were talking about kids, that's a couple hundred more students graduating on time in 2018 than we saw the previous year. State Superintendent Sherry Barr took some heat last year during the campaign for really inflating and exaggerating the improvement in graduation rates when really the numbers were statistically flat and we were talking about a minuscule improvement that translates to maybe a couple of students out of 20,000 high school seniors across the state. This is a solid improvement, and it is a high water mark. The way the state is now calculating high school graduation rates, kind of using this four-year tracking that most other states have been doing for years, this is a pretty solid improvement. And, we always harp on some really negative statistics. This is one where the numbers really did show some solid improvement.
Not a smidge and a smudge?
No. To use the term that Sherry Ibarra used to describe the improvement, this is not a smidge or a smudge. I mean, this is This is a couple hundred kids. This
well, there you go.
Significant.
But is it the haves and have-nots as far as district to district?
Oh, I haven't looked district to district, but there are definitely still those demographic gaps that you see in almost everything in education. I mean, the graduation rate for Hispanic students, for American Indian students, well below the state averages, which, you know, unfortunately, that is something that we see over and over in just about every education metric. So there's still a lot of work to be done. And what we also don't know about these numbers is where does this put Idaho nationally, because we don't have 2018 figures nationally.
Okay, George, I want you to wrap it up because we apparently have a glut of cheese and it's affecting
the
Idaho's dairy industry.
Well, it's a national glut of cheese. This was an NPR story where they, the way they put it was you could wrap the surplus of cheese around the U.S. Capitol a couple of times.
Well, people just need to start eating more cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you can imagine what the Idaho Dairymen's Association has to say about this. And they point to the tariffs and they point to, these are really, really hard times for the Idaho dairy industry. And dairy is, if it's not king, it's pretty close here in Idaho as far as not only the jobs, but the supplementary jobs and the economic engine. So this cheese surplus, which is a national issue, is hitting Idaho particularly hard.
When we heard a lot about that during the NAFTA renegotiations with certain threats from Canada as far as cheese coming into their borders and whether or not that might have a huge impact on Idaho, I'm not sure if this is necessarily coming from that, but I know the dairymen have obviously been very concerned about a lot of things going on globally when it comes to both cheese and dairy products.
Yep.
This is fascinating. I mean, because when you think about the tariffs, I mean, I think the average person would have never thought about cheese, but then that trickle-down effect to
Absolutely.
The dairy industry and how it comes back to our economy here in the Gem State.
And the next piece is yogurt. Which is now a major indicator, obviously, in the Magic Valley. Mm-hmm. These are real jobs. This is real money.
I want to thank you guys for coming in. We're out of time. My guests today, Seth Ogilvie, George Prentice, and Kevin Richard. Thanks so much, you guys. Always love this segment.